This is Voice of the Cape Drive Time. Going places. Getting there.
91.3, welcome back to the show. A few days ago, fighters pledging allegiance to the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, ISIS, ISIL, IS, take your pick, released a video claiming to show the killing of 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians kidnapped in Libya. On Monday, in revenge for the beheadings, Egypt carried out dawn airstrikes against IS targets in Libya. It was Egypt's first confirmed military intervention since the 1990 Gulf War. To make matters even more complicated, yesterday a Libyan commercial plane bound for Istanbul was forced to return to Tripoli after Egypt banned overflying its airspace, airport and airline. The ban will push Libya, battling to contain violence within its borders, further into isolation. Online, to help us understand exactly what's going on, is Jason Pack, a political analyst and founder of a website called LibyaAnalysis.com. Jason, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
And of course, we're looking at a situation in Libya that certainly doesn't seem to be moving towards the better. It seems to be fragmenting by the week. Your take on that?
Well, it's fascinating. There actually was some progress over the last 2 to 3 weeks prior to the now infamous beheading of 21 Coptic Christians in Sirte. And that progress had to do with the UN peace talks or mediation efforts in Geneva and Radames. But as you pointed out, even those successes lead to fragmentation. We had what you might call a civil war between Operation Dawn, which are the Islamists in the west of the country, and Operation Dignity, the anti-Islamists in the east. But now the situation is far more complex, that each of those groups have moderates and hardliners, and then we have a third force, which seems to be ISIS and their increased presence in Libya.
What do you make of Egypt's intervention? Obviously, Egypt are very angered by what they witnessed on these infamous IS videos, but that it's almost a unilateral action, I suppose, politically speaking.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of the media hasn't been pointing out that Egypt has been intervening in Libya for more than a year, and they've just used the beheading of their citizens as a pretext for further intervention. They've been supporting General Haftar in Operation Dignity since he launched that movement about 9 months ago, and they've used every opportunity to bomb places in Libya, to attack Islamists, and I think that they're making a grave error because they lump together the extreme jihadists, like ISIS, with more moderate Muslim Brotherhood elements that they're opposed to politically, and that only helps the extreme jihadists grow, this lumping them together with other groups.
So would you say, in essence then, that the Egyptian intervention, and you've just pointed out that the intervention has been much longer term than most of us have been led to believe, you say about a year or so, that Egypt in fact is going to be, could be an agent of the old classical divide and rule, but in this case more by default than design?
Maybe. I mean, I don't know if they divide and rule. Rather, in a way, Egypt is in the role of a Western country that stupidly thinks it can intervene in an Arab country and just props up its supporters, not realizing that that polarizes the conflict and achieves the opposite of its aims. The best thing for the Egyptians or the West to do would be to be mediators between the different factions and not simply to support General Haftar because he claims to be fighting the terrorists. Supporting General Haftar has made there be more extremists, more arms proliferation, and has been extremely negative.
One of the Libyan diplomats, Sheikh Arif Nayed, has just written what he sees as a sort of a longer-term solution to the Libyan crisis. Have you been able to read his proposals?
I know Arif very well, but he's aligned with the pro-Tobruk faction. He is a Haftar supporter. And like many who are operating in the West and meeting today at the UN, they are trying to simply pull in the EU and the Western countries on behalf of the Egyptian Haftar position. That's a recipe for disaster, which will likely cause the backlash of, say, taken interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan. We need to be neutral mediators rather than supporters of one side in this proxy conflict.
That's an interesting statement you make, neutral mediators. I'm sure a lot of foreign powers that feel that intervention is always the solution would be somewhat nonplussed if you were to come and tell them that. But it does make sense, doesn't it, that surely the long-term solution to Libya's problems is somehow to try and get everybody around the same table, and as painful as it is, to try and thrash out the issues.
Let me make an analogy. Of all the Arab countries that went through the Arab Spring uprisings in 2011, only one has succeeded, and that's Tunisia. Why? That's because the moderate Islamists of the Nahda, which is a Muslim Brotherhood-aligned party, were willing to accept former members of the dictatorship, excuse me, into their regime. And that allowed for a political bargain to be struck. In Libya, the anti-Islamists didn't make a deal with the Islamists, and the Islamists tried to ban all former Gaddafi supporters from serving in government, and that's created the tension that's led to this current conflict.
It does, if we look at the Tunisian example, in a sense sound short-sighted, doesn't it? Because you might have somebody who was a very good bureaucrat, somebody who could run an oil refinery, and that person would not have got the job if they were not perceived as a Gaddafi support. In other words, what I'm probably trying to say is the person's support of Gaddafi may not even have been political, but pragmatic, so that they could get a job and run something.
That's exactly right. And this is the reason that you can't have a kind of debathification or pure lustration. You guys know this very well with the South African experience. When the transition happened in 1994 and afterwards, you couldn't ban any white Afrikaans from serving in government because they had the skills and the know-how. You needed to have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Libya has lacked that, and the only way to move forward is to bring moderates on the Islamist side, moderates on the anti-Islamist side, some former Gaddafi officials, all of them in a coalition against the Islamists. Anything other than that will just make the conflict go on and on and on.
What is the general sentiment in the streets of the Libyan cities in places like Tobruk, Tripoli, and Benghazi?
Well, I wish I could say it was as nuanced and as peace-loving as our conversation that we're having today.
Right.
But it really isn't. Even my friends have become radicalized, and their family members, in the sense that when you know people who've been killed or the situation is not working to your best interest, you're likely to blame people who are not from your locality or not from your tribe, and this radicalizes things. Tragically, even among my peers who are non-Arabs but are Libya analysts, we've become more fragmented into different camps because of how polarizing the situation is.
It must be really difficult because, I mean, even before the crisis in Libya, it was, I don't think many people realized that it was quite a divided society, not in the negative sense, but family allegiances. Some people call it tribal. I don't want it to be too crude with the word tribal because it has negative connotations in South Africa. But there were these allegiances, weren't there?
Of course. I mean, Libya is a constructed country. It has three Ottoman provinces of Cyrenaica, Tripolitania, and Fezzan. But even more so, it spans a huge area that's very unpopulated. So there are different dialects. There are some ethnic divisions, but for the most part, the country is 90-plus percent Sunni and Arab. But it was never a nation. There was never an authentic Libyan nationalism. And this has meant that constructing an identity where people trust each other and are willing to share resources doesn't exist. As crass as it sounds, when it comes down to it, what's happening in Libya is a struggle over oil, right?
Mm-hmm.
Each region wants to have more power so that they can extract the oil and benefit financially. As the two sides, or three sides, or seven sides are fighting it out, the Islamists find this a fertile ground to excuse me.
No problem.
To recruit and to finance their activities. And because the central state has imploded, that's the natural breeding ground for an ISIS-like situation. I'd like to say that Libya doesn't have much in common with Syria because it lacks its sectarian divisions or history of intercommunal violence, but it does seem to be that the recipe of a collapsed and illegitimate state structure and no natural identity leads to Libya moving towards the kind of Syria trajectory of being a place in which ISIS can grow and breed very easily.
It's tragic, isn't it? Because if one looks at Libya's oil wealth, it does seem to me as if the oil was running through the wells and into the refineries, that Libyans, it's a small population, would be it would be a very prosperous country. In fact, I always felt that it was very underdeveloped and should have been something like Kuwait or Dubai. It should have been as developed as that. The city should all be shining, as it were.
Well, there's the fascinating story, which is that in 1971, the then head of the United Arab Emirates came to Libya to seek medical treatment, and he said that he wished that Abu Dhabi could become like Tripoli. So that shows you that this was a wealthier and more advanced place than the Emirates only 40 short years ago. Tragically, we know what's happened in the legacy of Gaddafi and then afterwards. But what your comment points out is that oil can drive conflict. Oil could be
right,
a source of job creation, but it tends to drive rivalries and conflict in a society that has no democratic traditions or national identities because of the way in which oil gives wealth without needing education or sharing, because the government monopolizes the wealth and hands it out to the people to placate them. So we've seen in other societies, such as, for example, Nigeria and elsewhere, that the oil-led development model has many problems, tending to lead towards imbalanced regimes.
And in fact, in Africa, where we come from, Angola is the most strident example of how wrong it can go in terms of the general population benefiting from it. Angola with one of the highest growth indices in the world, but the growth is confined just to one family.
Yeah, I mean, that's a story that we see the world over. How will Libya exit this trap? You know, no one knows. It would seem to me that it's going to be a very long process, but it won't happen until Libyans are willing to sit down and share with each other, put aside their petty jealousies, and form the kind of grand coalition that we've mentioned. And I think at the moment the only hope for that is the UN negotiations, because internal Libyan methods of conflict resolution have been tried, and they have not worked because there's been no neutral mediator and there's a lack of trust. Whereas Bernardino León, the head of the UN support mission in Libya, he is actually trusted and spoken to by all the parties. What I'd like to see is international actors ramping up their interest and treating Libya as a top-tier issue, i.e. up there with Ukraine and Syria and Iraq, because it needs that kind of attention and carrots and sticks to motivate the actors to move in the right direction. But military intervention, as we know, is not the way to go.
One thing that I haven't seen any movement on is the African Union. I mean, Libya, after all, is part of Africa, and the late Colonel Gaddafi was a keen protagonist of Libya being a role player in Africa. What's your take on the African Union, which to all intents and purposes has sat on its hands and looked at Libya and done nothing?
Well, the reason for that is actually in the history that you told. Because Gaddafi aligned himself with the sub-Saharan African states, the sub-Saharan African states are now distrusted, and I even go so far as to say hated inside Libya. Libya has become a very racist society whereby Libyans of black ancestry, even if they're purely Libyan and speak perfect Arabic, suffer great discrimination. For example, Jacob Zuma is a reviled political leader in Libya because of his role and connections between the ANC and Gaddafi. So the African Union is not going to have a role in mediating this conflict in Libya. Libyans look much more towards their partners in Italy, France, the UK, or in the Gulf countries with whom they have reoriented their relationships. Unfortunately, what's happening is the flow of migrants from sub-Saharan Africa, who now use Libya increasingly as a jumping-off point for Europe, has meant that African life is considered cheap in Libya, and the militias frequently do human trafficking and almost, you know, slave-like conditions towards black Africans. Very sad situation, but I see that getting only worse over time.
Of course, something that I've never seen much mention of is that shortly after the uprising in 2011, and I was one of the journalists there, is that there was a huge there was xenophobia of the worst kind was expressed against so-called black Africans, because some of Gaddafi's mercenaries came from countries such as Nigeria, Chad, and other surrounding countries. I mean, has that ever seen the light of day, the amount of, you've just briefly mentioned it now, the amount of racial xenophobia that there is in Libya?
Here's how I'd like to put it. We know that many of the Arab countries blame the Jews in Israel for all their misery. You know, there's a pothole in the road. They say, oh, the Israelis fly here, blow up our roads to make us feel bad. But that kind of not taking responsibility and blaming it on others doesn't only extend to Jews and anti-Semitism. Black Africans are frequently blamed for taking jobs in Libya, bringing in diseases. You know, when there was an AIDS epidemic, they blamed, oh, it's all the Africans. There's tremendous xenophobia because Libyans don't want to take responsibility for the fact that they've failed to work with their own neighbors to deal with their own society. It's much easier to just blame it on the outsiders. Oh, you know, the blacks, the Jews, the Europeans have colonized us and screwed up everything. It's not our fault. I mean, I don't mean to be too crass, but that mentality still exists and is very conspiratorial and gets at the heart of why Libyans don't feel connected to each other and feel very victimized by their neighbors, by the outside world. And that narrative is going to have to change, but it can't do so until there's leadership. You know, a great leader like a Mandela figure says, we have to take responsibility. Yes, we've suffered, we've been victims, but we can't just blame the outside. We need to begin to fix things and accept even our former oppressors. You can get at that sense of leadership that, sadly, Libyans have lacked since the fall of Gaddafi, and I hope they will regain, because there are many educated and brilliant Libyans who have studied abroad and have the ability to connect people together. They just haven't been in the right positions of power.
Isn't that half the struggle? Because I think anybody who's been following the Libyan story would agree wholehearted with what you say, because when you scratch the surface, you find that there are a lot, as you say, of very well-educated, informed, politically literate Libyans, but one doesn't see them, as you say, where they should be.
Well, this may have to do with traditional patronage networks. What we've seen, in a way, is a returning to more primitive forms of social organization. If Gaddafi tried at different times to suppress the tribe and promote the tribe, as he was doing that, he was changing Libyan social structures. When he was overthrown, Libyans wanted to race back to their traditional identities. I'm a Zintani first, then I'm an Arab, then I'm from Jebel Nafusa, then I'm a Libyan. And these traditional identities mean that the old sheikhs, or the important families in the urban case, have been given a role of leadership which doesn't necessarily correspond to, you know, who has the skills and who's been educated. It's a natural development because Libyans are trying to find their own identity, but they have to move forward in doing that rather than moving backward.
Jason Pack, political analyst, founder of LibyaAnalysis.com. Thanks for chatting to us. You've managed to struggle through a cough. I know it's tough on radio when your throat keeps on tickling. I've been there, done that. I've got that T-shirt. But Jason, thanks for the interview.
It was a real pleasure. Next time I'll be better. I always like talking to you.
Not a problem.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
Bye.